Hello, this is David Marsh, Chairman of OMFIF, and I'm here to conduct the latest in a series of podcasts that we're doing with EY about the response to the COVID crisis and what the financial consequences are in a range of different financial businesses. I'm very pleased that here I am with Simon Woods, who has been chosen to be the response leader for EY globally to what's going on in the insurance industry. Simon is the leader for the strategy for the EMEA region, and he's also a veteran of the industry. He's been with EY now since 2014, and before that he spent 15 years cutting his teeth in various investment banking operations. So welcome to the podcast, Simon. And first of all, can you tell me what you think the response has been generally, and what the consequences are in terms of just things like people and operations and technology? These insurance companies are coming under major challenge across the fields. What does it mean for them in those particular areas?
Well, David, thank you very much for having me on this podcast. I'm delighted to be here. In turning to your question around people, operations and technology, I think I could frame that in two ways. Sort of one, what was the immediate response? And now sort of what insurers are thinking about as they move forward into the next wave of the crisis. So the immediate response was very much around ensuring people were safe. So there was a lot of focus on ensuring that staff were safe and able to work from home. And also at the same time, making sure that business operations were up and running in a remote environment and the customers were looked after. So within days of the lockdown, there were a massive amount of calls coming in, particularly around things like travel insurance. And we've seen some of our customers have call center issues and have to recapture operations from India. But by and large, I would say the insurance industry, whether we're talking about in the US, in Europe or in Asia Pacific, has responded very strongly and has had no major issues on a people or operational perspective. However, having said that, I think the challenge now starts. And what we're seeing is a range of more complex issues for our insurers to focus on. And I see there's sort of six themes that we see prevalent amongst sort of COOs and HR departments at the moment. The first of those is the safe return to the office. Clearly, the lockdown continues in many parts of Europe and in the Americas, and we're seeing different attitudes around who should go back to work, who wants to go back to work, and how to do that in a logical way, but also in a safe way for people. So return to work or return to the office is a big issue. But closely allied to that is the question around the future operating model. I think people have been quite surprised around certain things that have happened positively around working from home. And I think the question is, do I need the office footprint I have today? Can I have a more flexible, agile workforce? So I think that's the next point, is really around how do I take positive lessons from the lockdown and take those forward, both in terms of the third theme around digital and technology adoption. And the fourth one is really around organization agility. So how do I become a more agile, responsive organization? And the final couple of themes sort of go together as well. One is, as a COO, how do I deliver ROI in investments? I think we're seeing a lot of focus on big projects, some of them being delayed, some of them being deferred. But the critical thing is for the business, for those people to deliver on the projects and deliver the returns. And at the same time, we're seeing a focus on strategic cost reduction, as broad by and large, we're seeing incomes come down across the sector and people are going to have around, one is what their cost base is, but also what their capability set is in the future.
Well, we'll come on to the whole question of finance in a moment. And basically, the insurance industry has sailed into quite a storm in many, many ways. But what you've said rings a bell, really, because a lot of this, surely, Simon, must have been things that different companies were thinking about doing anyway. And the extreme nature of the crisis has surely speeded up innovation in some sense. Can you give us a couple of examples also where somebody, you don't have to mention the names, but you could actually just mention companies generically, has done extremely well because they have been rather well prepared for all this? Can you think of some negative examples as well, where companies have been caught napping by these extreme challenges?
I mean, that's a great observation. I think a lot of our clients would also agree that this has been an accelerant to some of those trends we've seen there for some time. So in EY, we've run our next wave vision of the future in insurance. And the most recent one was in commercial and specialty lines. And I remember it coming out in February and reading this and feeling it was a bit like science fiction. And then we revisited it, I don't know, 2-3-4 weeks ago, and it felt like a lot of what we were talking about as the state of the industry in 2030 was happening now. And in terms of sort of who's doing well and who's doing less well, I think it's very much around the point I made about digital and tech adoption. So those insurers that have sort of pivoted to become a more digital organization are much better placed. So, for example, we're seeing usage-based insurance pick up. We're seeing some of the traditional sales channel fall down. So face-to-face distribution is a major issue for many, many insurers. So the people who've got a multi-channel approach and the ability to sell, service, and distribute their products through digital media are doing much better than those who are much more reliant on traditional business models.
So getting your retaliation in early, which I'm sure some companies have done, other ones are going to come out better as a result of all this. Let me just ask you about the finance now, because you can't imagine really a more perfect storm here. The company has been hit by a combination of three things all happening at once. One is a big increase in the payouts for all kinds of things, from travel insurance through to events, all sorts of areas where they're going to be out of pocket there. Secondly, premium income may well have taken a hit because of the fall in consumer income across the world. And then thirdly, on the investment markets, many companies have been very badly hit by these downfall in equities. There may have been a recovery since then, but we still have to cope with negative interest rates in many of the core areas where insurance companies like to invest on the prime government markets. What can companies do faced with this great array of financial challenges?
So I think, again, that's a very telling observation. And I think that one way to think about these impacts don't all happen at once. So what we're seeing is that there are three waves of this. One is the immediate fall in, as you say, equity values, the widening of bond spreads, and the further falling in interest rates. So that creates a solvency problem for companies. It's not necessarily a cash problem, but it's a mark-to-market effect. And what we've seen is many insurers have weathered that pretty well. There's been some regulatory forbearance as well to avoid pro-cyclical behaviour. We've also seen insurers raise capital coming out of the immediate aftermath of mid-March and, you know, either raise equity or debt as markets have reopened. So that's the immediate solvency issue. I think that you then point to two longer term issues. One is the extent to which there's a loss of income, either due to falling premium volumes or lower returns on investments. I mean, I think that certainly on the return on investment, that is a question about reinvestment risk as opposed to the immediate fall of income. So many insurers have matched assets with liabilities and so have locked in income, so long as there are no defaults. I think longer term, and this is the sort of $64 million question, is really how severe is the recession? How long does it take to get back to normal? And what does that mean both for sort of the health of insurance companies, so the affordability of premiums, but also their investment books? And what is the likely default and downgrade experience?
You're looking at companies across the world, Simon, in different jurisdictions. I know it's very difficult to make general comments here, but can you see some tendencies, some trends in different jurisdictions? You know, are the Americans more bullish than the Japanese, for example? Because after all, some of these chief executives, they must have some gut feeling about how long the stagnation or downturn is going to go on. And some might see the green shoots of recovery coming up in the second half, which would mean that, say, premiums would start to recover. Is there anything generic you can say about the general level of, you might call, capitalist spirits in the industry, let's say in America, in Europe, and in Asia?
Yeah, I mean, I'd start off by breaking that down into sub-segments of the insurance industry and then come to geography. So what we are seeing is that the P&C business, so the property casualty or non-life business, people are a lot more bullish and optimistic around that, particularly in places like the London market or some areas of reinsurance where we're seeing rate hardening, so that the price of risk is going up due to a shortage of capital. So I think in the P&C world, there's a much higher degree of optimism around future growth prospects once we're through the immediate crisis. Whereas in the life insurance business, I think people are more sanguine. We're seeing a bigger drop off in new business. And with low interest rates and the fall in markets, it's much harder to see that market coming back, or the new business in life and savings coming back.
Maybe the people, sorry to interrupt, but maybe the people working in life generally are a bit more dour, are they, than the people working in the property?
I think the velocity of the life business is clearly much lower than that of the non-life business. So what I mean by that is liabilities are much, much longer, sort of typically sort of 20, 30 years, and therefore it takes longer for those books to turn over, whereas the ability to reprice and reinvent yourself on the P&C side is a lot easier given the shorter nature of the business. So I agree. Coming back to your geographical question, I would say we definitely see different responses depending on the state of the lockdown. So I would say that if I look across Asia, particularly in China, there's been almost a return to normality. There's been some really interesting things in the Chinese insurance market. around innovation, new ways of servicing customers, and that's slowly drifting its way westwards. So I think sort of naturally, you know, the Anglo-Saxon world tend to be a little bit more immediate in terms of their responses, whereas the European model tends to be a bit more cautious. And that also reflects some of the ability to flex your business model. So what we see in sort of continental Europe is that, you know, the need to consult around staff, around other regulation, which is less apparent in North America. But I think it's hard to generalize at this stage exactly where the industry is going to come out. I say, I think the segmental view is easier to see those trends than the geographical view at this stage.
If one was to look at a particular area of the European industry where people have been complaining, that I mean the insurance industry executives, that is in the area of negative interest rates, particularly in Germany. And because there has been a safe haven effect of the crisis, negative interest rates on the government bond market probably here to stay. Has that had a particular impact, do you think, on the European business in terms of getting ready for the future? Because a lot of people are worried about whether, say, smaller insurance companies, let alone the bigger ones like Allianz, will have solvency problems.
Sitting in Switzerland, where I think we have the lowest negative interest rates in the world, on the most negative interest rates, the question is really one of ALM actually, rather than negative interest rates per se. And I mean, you mentioned I'd been in investment banking. So before I joined EY, I was in the business of risk management. And whenever we tried to sell interest rate derivatives, people were telling us that rates couldn't go any lower if they hadn't hedged. And clearly for the last 15 years, they keep on falling. So the good news about that is that, you know, a negative interest rate environment is not a surprise to many Europeans. It's more of a surprise in the US, where rates have traditionally been a lot higher. So I think you talk about Germany. Clearly, the Bund is a safe haven instrument at the moment. But we have had negative interest rates in Germany before in the last sort of 2 or 3 years. And so many insurers are now ready. And you know, the regulators in Europe have been quite focused on ALM. And that's a key point of Solvency II, is to bring out the view of asset and liability matching. So I think in the short term, we're not expecting negative rates to cause solvency problems. I think the bigger issue, as I mentioned, is the ability to sell new product. So a lot of traditional or a lot of life insurance coverage in Europe relies on guarantees. And it's very hard to provide guarantees that are cost effective and meaningful in the current interest rate environment. So even a zero guarantee, which most people would not put a lot of value on, is a very expensive guarantee to provide at the moment.
What about the recovery that will come surely as night follows day, even though it might be a very sluggish one, a bit like after 2008, 2009? I know you're very keen on the social purpose of insurance. Also, can you tell us a bit about how the regulators are combining with the insurance industry? You have to get close to the regulators, as one does in times of crisis. You don't always want to be close to the regulators, but could it be that this combination of, quote, social purpose, end quotes, and the closeness to regulators could help drive the recovery and drive individual companies' contribution to that recovery in a positive direction?
Absolutely, David. So I think the first thing to remember about insurance is it works quite differently from banking. So traditionally, and very simplistically, banks lend money to individuals and that's paid back, and there are, you know, some defaults. So by and large, the money flows and then there's loss experience later. Insurance operates the other way around. So everybody pays a premium and then some people have a loss event in the future. So the reason I pick up on that is that insurance suffers relative to banking in terms of the ability to inject a lot of money into the economy quickly. It's a bit like somebody said, you know, if you have a car accident and then ring up your insurance carrier or insurance company after you've crashed and say, I'd now like to buy insurance, then clearly that's not a great time for the insurance company to be providing insurance. That analogy is very true here, where there's been a massive amount of loss and it's very hard for the insurance industry to provide cover retrospectively. So that's one of the big debates at the moment, and you will have seen this in the press in many countries around business interruption coverage and this view that even though the contractual terms excluded pandemic risk, insurers should have paid anyway. Nobody looks at the small print. That's a huge issue for the industry at the moment and is part of the erosion of trust in the industry. That said, I think our clients are very optimistic around the role that insurance can play going forwards. I think that there are a number of options, and we're working with insurance companies, with industry regulators, but also governments. And I think what we see is really three different potential models. The first one is using the insurance loss adjusting mechanisms to get money fast to people. So to effectively pay claims through that network of agents, which would be complementary to the banking channels. The second one would be to provide risk cover for essential get back to work or get the economy going types of businesses. So for example, underwriting vaccine supply chains, providing trade credit or whatever it is. And then I think more grandly, there's talk of pandemic re or PREA, which is a very similar concept to the post 9/11 terrorist covers, which were called TRIA in the US, which is then providing some kind of government stroke country backed fund such that if there were a future pandemic, there would be the funds available.
So who do you talk to about all these things then? Say, just sticking to Europe for the time being, it all sounds fascinating what you're talking about in terms of new products, and I'm sure this could be part of the new message that the industry has. But at a time when the regulators have their hands pretty tied by just coping with the present crisis, who do you talk to in, say, the industry regulation area to talk about new innovative products for the future?
So I think it has to be done at many levels. So there's the company level view. So it's important to get the right sponsorship from individual companies. And quite often what we're seeing is that is a CEO agenda item at the moment. And then the question is, how do you engage both the industry and, as you say, the regulator and the governments? What we're seeing is that regulators are very engaged on this. So I had a call with a very senior regulator in Europe on Friday. You know, it's a key part of macroprudential stability at the moment is the ability for, whether it be insurance or banking, to come together to provide funding and risk capacity for the economy to get it going. So I think there's a huge amount of engagement with senior regulators, both on the prudential side and on the conduct side, so the customer side. And that links in very closely to finance divisions of government. So we see clearly a lot of focus within the finance ministries across Europe with around the cost of the furlough schemes, the potential hit to tax revenues, and a great desire to get economies going again. So I think the door is firmly open to good ideas, particularly ones that don't require immediate cash contributions from governments, as we're already getting into concerns around the extent of the deficits. So I think it will be a coalition of industry, of regulators, and of governments to make these things happen.
Is this specifically linked to the fear or the threat of pandemics? After all, pandemics have been with us since biblical times. They're nothing new. Or are they generally regarding the threat to society of enforced lockdowns for whatever reason, which could be due to terrorism, it could be due to natural catastrophes, they could be due to other interruptions to the globalized supply system? Because it seems to me if the insurance industry could work together with governments and regulators across the world to, that slightly hackneyed phrase, make the world a safer place, end quotes, then everybody would win from that. So can you give me an inkling of the kind of threats that you're looking at?
Yeah. So, I mean, in very simple terms, that people are not so worried about the pandemic per se. I think it's much more the societal impact of the lockdown and the consequent financial impact. So if you sort of think we've spiraled down through a combination of health worries leading to lockdown, leading to economic slowdown, I think the desire is to sort of reverse that spiral. So provide confidence around health. So I talked about, you know, reinsurance providing support to the supply chain around vaccine production. I hadn't realized until a few weeks ago, for example, how unstable or fragile vaccines are in terms of transportation, for example. So sort of providing security around the vaccine getting from country A to country B in a usable format. I think the temperature range is, you know, plus or minus 0.1 or 0.2 degrees centigrade, for example. So that's it's a delicate job delivering these vaccines, and so providing coverage around that is important, because then with risk financing comes the ability to lend or borrow money against it, and then we sort of spiral back up. It's about getting the economy going again, which is providing risk coverage, you know, providing confidence to small business owners, for example, that they can reopen. So we've seen examples of that in Switzerland and Germany, for example, where the insurers are paying out already on business interruption claims to the restaurant industry or the Munich beer gardens in order to get those businesses going again. But if you still think about it, as soon as a business has insurance coverage, it's then much easier for a bank to lend the money to get them going again. And therefore, that creates the confidence and momentum in the economy. So I think it's a combination of removing the medical concerns, but much more about providing confidence that businesses and people can get going again. And as you say, that then creates a safer world.
Yes, it's a part of an ecosystem, isn't it, really? Just synthesizing all that we've been talking about in the last 25 minutes or so, Simon, it seems that there's three main strands, really, to what you might call the successful insurance company of the future. One, you've got to get all the nitty-gritty right, all the things that could have come awry and maybe have come awry for some companies, the people, the operations and technology, got to keep a handle on that. Secondly, without the finance and without some powerful systems, without making a mess of things from a financial point of view, even the companies with the best ideas are going to go under. And then thirdly, this eye for innovation and an eye for the bigger picture, even as the world is grappling with crises, you've got to keep your eye on the ball for the future. Are there any companies in your knowledge that can combine the best of all these three worlds? Because it's a pretty tall order, actually. And also, won't there be an extremely punishing time where the weakest go to the wall and there'll be inevitable consolidation with the weakest either disappearing, getting taken over, and a few brand leaders emerging? Or will it be a thousand flowers blooming? What does the future look like from your point of view?
Maybe this is the time to open my hedge fund and move out of consulting. So I think what we see at the moment is there are a few attributes of success. So coming into the crisis, and as we looked at it, I don't know, 8 weeks in, the bigger, stronger companies are generally better placed, better resourced to invest in either, as you say, the nitty-gritty, you know, the digital transformation, or have the financial wherewithal to weather the storm. So we certainly see the bigger groups being in a stronger place than the mid-sized companies. But on the other hand, there is a cost of size, which is a lack of agility. And I think what we will see is that now is a time where the market is moving rapidly. I'm not talking just about the financial markets, but in terms of customer affordability, customer preference, how things are done. So my general feeling is the winners will come from a combination of the bigger groups who have the agility to amend their strategy to take advantage of opportunity, and the more agile, more digital startups with enough financial wherewithal to survive. I think those two groups are winners. And then I think inevitably we are going to see some capacity come out of the market. So we're already working on M&A deals around people who are having rating agency capital challenges, for example. We're seeing some of the really exciting fintech technology companies struggle with funding and looking for safer homes. So I think there will be consolidation. And the other one that, from my capital markets background, is the rise of alternative capital. So that's been a big driver of lowering returns in the sector as hedge fund capital comes into the insurance and reinsurance industry. I think that the question is how long that money will stay around given the opportunity to invest in other parts of the market now at higher returns, and also some of the losses they've seen come through. But if that capital starts coming out of the market, then we'll see the rate cycle in the P&C market much more dynamic, and therefore that will reward companies in that market.
Well, Simon, you've given us quite a good running down of where we are now in the different industry fields that you're dealing with in insurance. I think the way that you've put the different challenges that all these companies has to face has been pretty compelling. And you've also just given us a view about the future. If you just had to just answer this in a couple of sentences, whether you think the future will belong to the small, nimble startups, you mentioned fintech and so on, or to the established behemoths, the ones that will really make a go of consolidation because they've got size on their side, which would you choose to be the ones that will be really the trailblazer for the next 5 to 10 years?
It's a good question. I personally think that the more open-minded big players will be the winner. I think then, getting back to my point around sectors, people who are slightly more biased towards non-life and risk products will be able to accelerate out of this more quickly than people who have large life businesses. And that goes back to my point around the velocity of the balance sheet. It's easier to turn a non-life business around to write better rates and to innovate in those companies, whereas I think there will still be a drag of legacy books, particularly in a low interest rate environment where the guarantees that have been written in the past will continue to be very capital intensive and drag both capital returns and resources. So I think it's a question of, you know, who has the ability to redeploy resources to growth areas and who has those resources. So the good startup companies, absolutely, as well as the more agile, bigger companies.
Good. Well, that's a very good place to end it, Simon. This is David Marsh, the chairman of OMPIF. I've had a very good conversation with Simon Woods, the industry leader for insurance at EY. You've really summed up that the company of the future will be the large, sprawling company with a lot of financial muscle that combines the best of the small company approach. So maybe a large company with lots of startup mentalities within it, that might be the one to go for. Simon, thanks very much for talking to me about the industry's challenge and the future. And this is David Marsh from OMPIF signing off. Thank you for listening.